Button your cardigans and zip up your recess coats. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, October 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we explore what's in your closet that could feel at home at the front of the classroom. Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur unpack the messages clothes project to students and other educators. Today's Teacher Talk is all about teacher fashion. Laura Edwards is South Dakota State climatologist. She joins us with a weather outlook. Plus, Achut Deng is with us. We will talk about her memoir, Don't Look Back. It's the story of her journey escaping war in South Sudan and her experiences as a refugee in America. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Drought in South Dakota continues. Let's check in now with Laura Edwards for a look at that as well as an updated outlook. Edwards is state climatologist at South Dakota State University.
Yeah, it really has been dry, and not just East River, really all across the state. Over the last month and a half to 2 months, we've seen increasing area of dryness and drought and increasing severity in some of the areas that were already in drought. We don't have all of the official records from September, but we do know we had a number of areas that were record driest in the east and the south, and record warmest in the northwest and west. And so there is an area where those two overlap. And here so far for October, it's been very minimal, if anything, of rainfall. So as we look overall the last 60 days, we have almost everywhere East River and almost all across the south, less than 25% of average rainfall in the last 60 days. And the remainder of the west and northwest, less than 50%. But, I know some of those areas have really gotten, less than a tenth of rain, in the last month and a half or so. So it really has been dry and amplified with the warm temperatures we've had for the last several weeks as well.
Yeah, so we've talked about the fire risk, but what are other impacts are you seeing in other industries from the ag industry, construction industry? Are people calling you and telling you what's going on and how hard it is for them right now?
Yeah, and the fire risk goes into the agriculture sector as well. We've seen a lot of fires started with harvest activities. Also we've seen poor emergence of winter wheat, that didn't get enough moisture to get started. And some of those cover crops that people like to plant also in the fall season. But on the plus side, on agriculture, we've had a lot of grain dry down in the field, soybeans and corn, and the market is pretty poor right now for those two commodities. And so avoiding the extra cost of drying after harvest has been a plus, I think, to corn and soybean farmers. In other industries, I know like construction and those kinds of folks are really happy to kind of have this extended warm time, where we just had a handful of days that got really cold below frost. So it's really looking like they're making a lot more progress this fall on construction activities than they were expecting anyway.
Yeah. All right. So what's coming ahead?
So what's coming ahead, at least for this week, still continued warm and dry for the most part. Our next best chances of rain look about 1 to 2 weeks from now. We start to see a little wetter pattern setting up. But really, as we look out the next 1 to 3 to 4 months, nothing really consistent on moisture. And as we look at La Nina being our primary factor in the winter season, La Nina doesn't tell us a whole lot on moisture, on precipitation or snowfall. So we're kind of in equal chances of wetter, drier, or near average for moisture through the winter season. And on the temperature side, yeah, we're going to end October on the warm side. But as we look further ahead into the winter season, I think we'll see more colder temperatures than not. And the official outlook from NOAA's Climate Prediction Center shows and odds or chances leaning towards colder, especially as you get in a later winter season into January and February.
Yeah, but not necessarily high precipitation, at least
That's
at
right.
first.
And yeah, that's right. Not much more for precipitation. People have the perception that we get more snow in La Niña years. But I think that's mostly driven by the fact that we get colder temperatures. So more precipitation falls as snow, not necessarily that we have more precipitation in general.
Anything else that you want to add about new science and our climate predictions? Are there things that you're excited about in your field?
Yeah, I think we take the impacts of climate a lot more seriously, and we try to look more broadly. Outside of what I just told you on temperature and precipitation outlooks, that could increase heating costs, especially for those who are remote areas and tribal lands. Could mean deeper frost depths if we don't have more snow on the ground. So that could affect utilities and water supply. And so we coordinate a whole lot more across the region, even on the multi-state region, to help inform and kind of get ahead of these challenges before they happen. And so I think that's what I'm really excited about, and that people are getting kind of beyond the data and
Yeah.
more into what does that mean on the ground.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Tis the season for a fashion update. Let's talk teacher fashion. Today's Teacher Talk will unpack the cardigans, sweaters, and leggings of our educators. We'll explore what not to wear and lay out a few wardrobe staples. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. And Gina Benz is a Roosevelt High School teacher in Sioux Falls. She's also an adjunct professor at Augustana University, the University of Sioux Falls, and the University of South Dakota. This is her 25th year of teaching. My stepmother, who was a teacher for a number of years, had a recess coat.
Oh, I love recess coats.
Such a good idea.
I kind of want one.
And I remember her telling me about the recess coat as we talk about teacher fashion. So, Jackie, as soon as you said teacher fashion, I thought of the recess coat, which is puffy and long.
All the way to the ankles.
All the way to the ankles. It covers everything because you will be standing out in all kinds of weather in South Dakota. So when you say teacher fashion, I think recess coat.
Yes.
I love it. What were the her requirements for the recess coat? Like,
just
do you remember just that?
Down to the ankles, very warm, covers everything.
Mm-hmm.
You can stand out there for long periods of time.
I'm going to add a hood to it.
Hood, yes, that was the hood. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Pockets.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Pockets. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. But you wanted to write about teacher fashion because why, Jackie?
A number of reasons. I've been seeing it come up in really fun ways. So there have been teachers who have become kind of Instagram famous or TikTok famous from showing off their teacher outfits.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. And then there's also this practicality piece to it. So something like a recess coat where you need to have, there's like, I don't know, you need a functional footwear.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to raise your arms over your head. You need to be able to get up and off the floor and back down again. There's all these things your clothes need to be able to do for you. And then I personally really like to express myself through fashion. And so, I don't know, there's also this piece of trying to look like oneself in this role of the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then something I didn't write about in the blog, but I've been thinking about since then, is that there's all these days that occur when you're a teacher too. Like, we dress up for homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
We dress up for weird sock day. And so you have to be ready to go for all of these like fashion days that are very specific to being a teacher.
Yeah, school spirit day.
School spirit day.
Yeah. How important is it, Gina, to high school students that their teacher shows up on some of those special days?
Actually, that was a big emphasis at my high school this year. The student council really petitioned the teachers to make sure you dress up, because the students have more fun if the teachers are dressed up. The students are more likely to dress up if the teacher dresses up. And I have to agree, I think it's true. And so I have my stash. I have my princess dress I can wear. I have my Oh, what's the hospital in Grey's Anatomy? Gray Sloan Memorial Hospital, whatever it is. I have that shirt for like a medical day. I've got my friend's t-shirt for a TV day. I've got it all stored away.
I love that.
Inappropriate pants for pajama day, right?
Yes.
Because I'm not wearing what I wear to bed, but I can buy something appropriate.
Pajama day is a tough one, isn't it? How about like favorite athletic team day? That can be a tough one too.
For sure.
If you wear the wrong team colors, you could alienate. Maybe you just go with your school's.
Well, I like to go with my school, but I, you know, I have a stockpile. A lot of times we have a college day, too. And is it going to be this college or that college this time? I just mix it up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Jackie, expressing yourself creatively and, you know, so we've talked about the practicality of things and some of the special things, but just getting, you are in front of students all day and therefore you're in front of parents all day. Mm-hmm. And you also want to be somewhat of an individual, but be, quote, professional. And you also found this sort of hot tip or hot take debate on what does it mean if you're a teacher to dress professionally.
Mm-hmm. All that rolled into one, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just thought that this topic was so fun. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized like there's underneath conversations or in some instances pretty overt conversations about what does it mean to be professional. And it is a really personal and decision on one's interpretation of professional, but also the public weighs in on what they would consider professional teacher attire. So I don't know. I read an article, in, as I often do, in Education Week, and was titled "What Does It Mean for Teachers to Dress Professionally?" And there was just kind of a lineage or an outline of the history of professional dress. And there used to be a period of time where women were required to wear skirts and men were required to wear ties, and that was a requirement of the profession. And so, as it's evolved, as time has gone on, I think people care because it's their kids. So they care what their teacher is wearing because they have an opinion about what they think the person who is teaching their children should be wearing. And also, I think, and I said this in the blog, the students are looking at that teacher all day and they're trying to see themselves in that teacher. And so they're trying to see what their future self looks like and what their future profession might entail. And so I think there's reasons to maybe not dress what is considered traditionally professional, but to show professional in a different sense. Like if you're the art teacher, what does it mean to be artistically professional? If you're the wrestling coach and you teach PE, what does that dress look like as professional? And so, it's a larger conversation.
If you're the librarian on Abbott Elementary, you get a fun hat.
You do need a fun hat. Couldn't agree more.
And Jackie had a fun hat when she was a librarian, right?
I sure did. Yes, I did. That was my favorite part. I didn't wear it. I carried it. It had magical items in it.
Yeah. And this has evolved a lot because going back to the recess coat, my stepmother had to wear heels.
Oh, she had to wear heels?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's terrible.
Her feet have not fared well.
No, I'm sure she's suffering
now.
In
her retirement year, she suffered and has had to have, you know, surgeries. And maybe she doesn't want me to reveal that. But it was difficult, that requirement. Mm-hmm. That's changed. So before you criticize those flip-flops and sandals, remember that the rule used to be heels.
Yes. Yes.
And that was no good either. Here's another reason I think parents complain about dress codes. And that is they might have a hard time telling who the teacher is.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
When you're an older parent and you see somebody who's really, really young, especially in a middle school, high school setting, they like to be able to identify the teacher. Is that a teacher or a student? They want to know the difference.
You know, when I started at my high school, brand new teacher, first year teaching, so I was 22, 23, and I needed to give a student an office referral, which meant I needed to go to the office and fill out a form because there was misbehavior in my classroom. And when I got to the counter, the clerical person said, "What'd you do?" Assumed I was a student. And so, Laura, you're exactly right. Teachers can be mistaken for students really early
on. Also, is that how you talk to the students? What'd you do?
Well,
it could have been a better way to address a student who was in some kind of trouble.
I don't know. You know, they deal with a lot throughout the day. But also, I'm at a big school, and so it may seem surprising to some that they didn't recognize me, but it wasn't surprising to me at all.
Yeah.
I had the opposite as a student. I always was mistaken for the adult in the room.
It can be hard to tell.
I just looked older in high school. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that happened to me fairly frequently.
Mm-hmm. All right, what makes a good teacher outfit fashion-wise? Jackie, I feel like you could write a book on this.
She could. Oh, that would be a fun book to
stylish,
write.
Oh, yeah.
Fun.
Consummate in style.
Mm-hmm. That means so much. I'm going to tuck that away for a day where I need to remind myself of a compliment. So thank you. I had a student once tell me that I dressed comfortably fancy. And I thought, yes,
I like
yes,
that.
I love that. It is really important, I think, when you're a teacher to be comfortable. You are on your feet all day. And there are consequences, as you just articulated, to not being able to have proper footwear. I can't imagine not having a good recess coat if you need one, right? You also, rooms are these, a lot of people teach in older buildings that are somehow both hot and cold at the same time. And so you need to be able to figure out how to adjust in layers and accommodate accordingly. And then, I don't know, for me, I just think that when I get dressed, I want to feel good in what I'm wearing. I have been at the front of the room and not liked what I've had on, and that's, for me, was always hard to teach in. I didn't like having eyes on me and not liking my outfit. I don't know that everyone feels that way, but for me, that's something that always mattered and still does when I'm in the front of the room. So I think that that's my, what makes a good teaching outfit is that it's comfortable and that you feel good in it.
That eyes on me really resonated, because there's few professions, I think, where you have 20, 25, 30 people staring at you for hours on end, right? You're basically giving speeches all day long.
Yep, right. You are.
What do you wear on the first day of school?
Oh,
first
fun.
First time your students are going to see you, what do you put on that day?
I love this question. I can think of the very first day I taught ever. So in 2010, I had this royal blue kind of shift dress, and I did wear tights and heels that day. And then I don't think I wore that outfit ever again, because I was like, oh, I couldn't move it as well in it as I wanted to. And heels can become pretty difficult at the end of a long day.
Yeah.
But I did wear it because it was just sharp looking. Like, I really liked the way I looked in that outfit. But now I would say I err more on, I feel like a blazer ups everything and can be easily taken off if needed. So I'll throw a blazer on now fairly frequently on the first day.
I mean, you bring up a good point, Lori. First impressions.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what clothes are. Clothes are often a first impression. And we don't want people to judge us based on our clothing, but they do. They say that all behavior is communication. Well, I think all attire is also communication. So, like, Lori, you look lovely today. You've got fall colors on, and it is kind of the beginning of fall, and you're communicating like you're embracing fall coming.
I'm here for it. I am here for fall coming.
Exactly.
I would dress, if I were dressing for an elementary school classroom, I would make sure I wore something that they could find me in again.
Aww.
And I say this because when my daughter was little and she was just starting to walk, I always wore red shoes. So that if we were out somewhere, she would, kids get lost amongst the legs of adults. And so I always had bright red shoes on when she was learning how to walk. So she would just look down and, could come and find me. So
that's,
if I were dressing,
tip.
I would.
That's
I would,
a pro tip.
I would make sure I wore something, so that if the kids were in the lunchroom and were a little confused and uncertain, they would be like, oh, there's that lady with that fun necklace on, or what have you, until they learned my face.
I love that.
I do too. And what I particularly like about it is the intentionality. And I think that for me is one of the big pieces around teacher fashion, is that you're just doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
I think you can make a justification for just about any type of attire, any particular look. But you have to know why you're doing it, and you have to do it with intention. And so people could say, oh, those red shoes are too flashy for being a teacher. People can find ways to criticize all kinds of things anymore. But you can say, no, I'm doing this so my students can find me amongst the sea of other feet. And then you have an answer. So I love that.
Or don't change your glasses too much at first. Or if you're if you have facial hair, maybe don't shave the first week of school.
So that students can recognize
kids
you.
Need to know, need to be able to recognize you.
And at the high school level, you're going to get a ton of comments about that. Do you want to field the comments all day long?
Yeah. Are kids critical in high school and middle school of how you dress?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's their job. Yeah, of course. We've established that it can be their developmental job to connect with you, and that might be weird shoes. I remember I had a pair of like felt clogs, you know, these Hofflinger clogs that I wore to teach, you know, as an artist in residency once. And the little kid said, "Are you wearing your slippers?" They want it. And I wore them because I could slip in and out of them, get down on, you know, sit on the floor, stand up, slip back into them. They were kind of colorful, but they were like, "Are those your slippers?" And I was like, "Yeah, pretty much." They are. Yeah, caught me.
Well, and you needed to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, Gabe Dannenbring, who's the TikTok teacher here in South Dakota, he's really well known for his fashion, and he does TikToks solely talking about what his students say about his fashion choices. And they do make fun of him, but he's able to take it all in stride because he knows he looks good.
Yeah.
And he just knows it's their job.
Didn't he get a partnership with Old Navy, too?
He did.
Yeah. Oh. For to show off teacher fashions. I just thought that was teacher super fashions. Fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, Old Navy is the store for teachers, I think. My daughter said that when she started her education major in college. She said, "One of these days, I'll be shopping at Old Navy for everything." And it's practical, it's affordable, but also, you know, put together.
Okay, what else? Hair?
Yes.
Hair, makeup.
All of that.
Nails, hair, makeup, nails, grooming, facial hair, mustaches or not, you know, that sort of thing. What does it matter? Cultural differences with hair and makeup. Mm-hmm. Also, when you say dress like yourself, and some people might not, you know, be comfortable with that. Well, guess what? You know, we have a diverse classroom. Mm-hmm. So hair, makeup, headscarves. What do you think, Jackie? All of it.
All of that. I think it's so important to show up as yourself as the teacher, all in the full capacity that you are, and a good version of yourself, the idealized version of yourself. I always felt like, and still do feel like when I'm getting ready for the day, it's like full of hope, you know? And I just think this is the best. I'm putting these clothes on to become the person that the people and the students need me to be. I'm doing this as like a way to prepare to become the best version of myself that I can. And that's why I think it's always been difficult for me when I have a morning where I don't really love the way I got pulled together, because it's like, I don't know, it's just part of my routine to say, this is me trying to look great so I feel great so I do a great job. And I think that is very individualized and specific to everyone. And so whether you have facial hair or not, or headscarves or not, or if you change your look up regularly or if you stay routinely the same, I just think that all of those decisions are very individualized, but they do need to be done with intentionality.
Our key takeaway is put some thought into it.
Absolutely.
Have some fun with it. Be yourself. Mm-hmm. Express yourself. Think about why, you know, what message you're sending. I love that.
LeVar Burton talked about that, too, that he recognized that he received some criticism for not having a consistent look, that wasn't common, that they wanted him to be recognizable from season to season. And he said, "I don't look like that anymore, so I'm not going to look like that on this show." Yeah. So he did that intentionally, too. So just interesting, I think.
Yeah, LeVar Burton from Reading Rainbow, in case anybody's not initiated into that.
Sorry, I'm just talking about him like he's my friend and we all know him so well.
He's amazing like that, but it was mostly the facial hair, I think. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the earring. He had an earring.
Right. There's more to this conversation. Find the full Teacher Talk segment online as part of SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. Go to sdpb.org or your favorite podcast platform. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Achyut Deng is the author of the powerful memoir, Don't Look Back. It's the 2024 One Book Siouxland title. You can hear Deng speak about her book at the upcoming event, From South Sudan to South Dakota, is at 7 p.m. in the Augustana University Chapel in Sioux Falls. Now, a note to listeners, the interview we're about to play includes descriptions of violence, war, sexual assault, and suicide. At 6 years old, Achyut Deng was driven out of her village in South Sudan on foot with her grandmother and her beloved dog by her side. They were separated from family and fleeing from rebel soldiers. It was the middle of the night. The escape was bloody and harrowing. Achut's dog was soon lost. Her grandmother died while protecting Achut from execution by soldiers. After walking more than 1,000 miles and surviving captivity, illness, injury, treacherous terrain, and near starvation, Achut arrived at Kakuma Refugee Camp in Kenya, where she lived for 10 years of her childhood. In the camp, she was adopted and protected by a friend of her mother's until extended family members demanded the child leave the single woman behind to live with them. Eventually, she would find her way to America only to begin another fight for survival. One of the older boys in her group sexually assaulted her repeatedly and controlled her every movement outside their apartment. She did not have words in English to explain what was happening to her. Her memoir tells the story of the cost of war, the complexities of coming to America, and what it means to fight for your own life. Achut Deng joined us in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio.
Don't Look Back, start with the title. It's from my grandmother. From the night of fleeing my village. And so we walked in the middle of the night, and I was scared. I was only 6 years old, and she said, Achut, don't look back. It will slow you down. And thus, I took that to my heart. So every time I find myself in a flashback, I'm like, no, don't look back. So I just keep pushing forward. So she saved me, and I want the world to see that. Yeah. You can visit your past, but make sure you are visiting it to move forward. Don't let that still control you. Yeah. So that's why I wanted that title. Life of Kakuma Refugee Camp was a disaster. That place is super hot. Mm. You know, you sleep outside. School, a class, like it would be one teacher and 120 student or 200. There's no pencil, there's no papers. So the life in Kakuma Refugee Camp was just a life of hope. Mm. Was just a life of hope. Buried my friends. You know, you go to bed with your friends, your classmate, and tomorrow you go to school and they're not there. So you just wait for your time to come.
Yeah.
So that life in Kakuma Refugee Camp, it was just terrifying. You just wait for your moment to come. Kakuma Refugee Camp, too, was the place that I learned how to forgive, because I was there as an orphan from a one tribe, and the other tribe that we had a fight with, they had their own orphan. So when I look at that, everybody's losing on both sides. These children are over here. So the Dinka is going to the other tribe and kill them. The other tribe is coming over here. And so it was a back and forth. So when I see these kids are going through the same struggle that I'm going through, mm-hmm. I had to let that go. Mm-hmm. I didn't see the point of me holding that, because they didn't do it. I didn't do that. So I really had to like look deep into me and say, I have to let it go.
Yeah.
So I learned the forgiveness. And pass forward, coming to America, just the name America, people were explaining that, oh my God, America is so awesome. It's a nice place. You have a chance of life. You have a chance of everything. So when I did my interview, I was not saying what everybody was saying. I want to be a doctor. I want to be a teacher. I want to be all kind of good things in the world. I told this man, hey, I'm not aiming for that. I just want life. I'm still a kid. If I can still enjoy this few years of my childhood, I'll be happy. I just want life.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to live in a fear of or in a hope. Mm-hmm. So when I got that chance and come to the United States, of course, I was happy. But then there was that life turned into a nightmare.
Yeah.
When I was in Kakuma refugee camp, I never thought of killing myself because I knew God was there, but also death was all over the place. You just wait for your time. But now I'm in America. There's food everywhere. There are some great teachers, you know, great healthcare. So I know if I get sick, they are going to save me.
Yeah.
So chances of just dying was never there. And the things that I was going through, I felt alone. You know, I was going through sexual assault. I'm being told not to say anything. Keep silent. If you say something, no one is going to believe you because you can't explain that. Mm-hmm. So I felt really alone. I was in the world that I did not have the voice. I find myself just standing there in the world. Now I feel lonely. When I was in Kakuma refugee camp, if I felt like that, at least I have friends. If I ever have to reflect back on this, I would have people. But when I came here, I didn't have nobody. I didn't have friends. There was no one for me to run to tell them. Mm. So I consider taking my life away was the best. But my grandmother came back. I felt her. I heard her sound. Her last word when she died was, "You are strong." And when she said that, I let everything go, everything that I had prepared to take my life away. Mm-hmm. A rope, I had that, and then a knife. I put them down. And I deal with that until December of 2002. And that's when I finally just ran away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I was placed in a a group home, and then transferred to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so my hope in those moments after my grandmother showed up in the closet was, you know what, I'm going to grow up. I'm going to be an adult. I'm going to be able to take care of myself. I can't right now, but there is tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that was my hope, and that is everything in that book. And that's what I want people to know and to understand. I also want people to just be aware of your surrounding, because you never know. A lot of people can have, including me, I can have a mask.
Yeah.
You know, at Walmart, I can have a mask on at job. But then when I'm done with the outside world and go back home, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I really would love, you know, just I want people to have an open eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you are a child escaping, you not only, your brain isn't developed, you don't understand the things that are happening. The things that you do understand,
yes,
are things no child should ever have to,
not at all,
be confronted with. And so much of the loss is just deferred. You can't grieve. You can't cry.
No.
You can't stop. You can't look back.
You become numb.
You become numb and completely surviving. But you are saying goodbye again and again,
again and again.
Again because either of a death or because you have to leave before your mother can find out where you're at.
Yes.
To a friend that, you know, to even making the ability to come to America and saying, I have to leave behind these people who aren't going to get out, and I feel guilty, too guilty to eat the food that you know that they cannot
eat. I still
eat.
Have that.
You still have that guilt? Yeah.
I still have that. It's hard for me to, like, go to a restaurant and post my a plate of my food.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, my God, what if somebody that I'm friend with, my own brothers are still in Kakuma refugee camp, and if I post this, and they see it, I still have that guilt.
Right.
You know, so it's hard.
In Houston, you go into a store for clothes, and there are enough clothes in that store to give to the entire population of Kakuma refugee camp.
Yeah.
And that disconnect, that that stress, and yet you need clothes. Yeah. So here we are wearing clothes.
Yeah.
Did working with another author on the book, did spending time telling your story help you sort through any of that?
Keely Hutton, who helps me with the book, she have her own way of writing the book. And we spent 2 weeks so that she can get to know me, so that I can trust her. Mm-hmm. Because now it was Keely first that is going to hear me. I will have to be honest and comfortable enough to tell my story. And then after her, my audience were my children. Mm-hmm. And I told her, my story is it's not great, and I don't want it to be raw. I don't want my children to open the book and read it and put it down. I don't want my children to be bullied at school. Mm-hmm. And so the way she did that, she did an amazing job because it's not happening. High school kids, middle school kids are reading it, and they see themselves. They, you know, anywhere I go now, it's like, oh, my God, thank you. And even the first generation of refugees, they goes, how can I ask my parents? Right. I want to know them. Where should I start it? And that's a blessing. So having Keely help me was great because she took her time.
Yeah.
When I was emotional, because some chapters I go through that to that moment.
Yeah.
For example, the death of my grandmother. Mm-hmm. I never had a chance. I was told she's gone. When somebody asked me, what's the last thing that you can remember? And if I go, it become live to me. Mm-hmm. It's like her blood. Mm-hmm. That chapter was real, and it took me to a different level of terror.
Yeah.
At my age. And so at this age, you know, as an adult.
Yeah.
And when that was happening, she took her time. And through writing the book as well, I went through the trouble, right? The nightmare. So I was able to be open to myself and call for help. So I mm-hmm. I was going through therapy.
Good. Yeah.
Once a week.
What was it like when your own sons turned 6 and 16? And watching them have a childhood, thinking back, reliving your own. I was 10 once, and I remember what was happening when I was 10.
It's a gift for me, because I refuse for my children not to have what I had never have. And even writing the book, right, my youngest one was 6 at the time. And when I was talking to them about the starvation in Kakuma, my youngest one, he goes, Mom, is that why you don't want us to leave any food on the plate? Is that why you tell us to finish the food? And I said, oh, my God. Yes, I did not realize, for real, like, this is actually my past.
Yeah.
You know, or when they throw the food away, it's like, don't do that. Why do you do that? And so all of them join into that. Like, yes, Mom, you shop and shop, and then the food go bad and expired. And that's not good for you. You work too hard. Right there, that moment, I realized, yes, I was living my past still. Mm-hmm. So every birthday, and sometime when they turn 10 and 15 and 16, it's like, these are still children. And 16, I was going through this.
Yeah.
I was never laughing. There was no laughing moment for me. I was emotionally abused, physically and mentally. There was no life in me. I was just empty. And so every time I do the birthday for them, of course I go back. I was this once. And this is what happened to me. I think that is probably going to stop at age 21 for me, because that's when I felt like I got myself.
Yeah.
This is it for me. But right now, I still go. I still go. at this age, this was going on with me.
Yeah.
So then I go above and beyond to put a smile on them. Yes. Yes.
A little something for the you as a child too.
Yeah.
Some delight.
Yes.
That you get to re-experience.
Yes, yeah. And because I don't know my birthday, everybody's birthday is mine.
Yeah.
So yes, you have a birthday today? I'm coming if you told me, or if I know, I'm coming.
Yes.
It's my birthday too. Yes.
This moment that you talked about in the closet where you're looking at a rope and a knife and you're thinking, well, I'm going to have to do something to make this stop. I'm going to have to end this on my own. And then you choose not to because your grandmother, this is a moment where you are choosing survival, partially because you have already survived so much. Talk about the difference between hope that there might be something else to planning for, you know what, I'm going to be 18 in 2 years, in 1 year, in 19 months. What was it like to learn how to plan for a future? Because in America, there are kids, people are asking them what they want to be when they grow up, when they're six.
Yeah.
Right? So they're, in some ways, they're planning for an adulthood at a very young age.
Yeah.
You do this at a later age when you have the capacity to all of a sudden say, I can ask for something more.
Yeah.
I can ask for something more for myself. What was that change
when
like
when I graduated,
in you?
I was 20.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? Mm-hmm. High school. When I was freshman, I was 16. And I live my life, I live in a moment.
Yeah.
So when I was in that closet and my grandmother came, that moment and the word, you are strong, I was upset at her. I want to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of this life. You know, I'll be saved when I'm there. But when she said, you are strong, and I remember that, I said, okay, I would just take it one day at a time, just like I did in the past. So to be honest with you, I never have any plan. Yes, my hope at that moment when I said, okay, when I'm 18, these things that I'm going through mm-hmm. will not happen to me because I will have the chance to say, back away, I'm grown, don't do this. And so that was my thing. I was on a survival mode. It wasn't even about when I'm 18, I will go to college. When I'm 18, I will make money. I was not even thinking about that.
Yeah.
It was just when I'm 18, this sexual assault that I'm going through, no one is ever going to do it to me because mm-hmm. I'm going to be an adult. So I start learning, you know, in America, when you are 18, you are considered as an adult. And so I'm like, when I'm 18, this man is not going to put this, oh, you are a child.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody believe children. And by then, I should be able to express and explain how I feel or what I'm going through. So I live my life in a moment. I don't have plans. Now my children, they have goals and short terms and dreams. And I love that for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, we want to do this. We want to be this. I love that because their life is amazing. And I would die for them to experience my life. So I am super, super happy that they have the chance to have the dreams and plan ahead.
What does healing look like for you now?
Since I put my life to the world, I feel so light.
Mm.
I feel light. I don't feel embarrassed. I don't feel ashamed. I don't feel like somebody is judging me. It's like, okay, well, if there's somebody out there that is judging me, that's their issues. It's not mine. So I feel really, really, I feel very good about it. And right now I have time to say, you know what? I'm going to take 20 minutes to myself. No TV. No phone. Kids, go do whatever you want. I want to sit here with nothing going on. Just want to stare at the sky.
Yeah.
And it give me peace. Or listening to music or going to the gym. So I'm giving myself alone time a little by little.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What's one of your best memories?
For my compound, if I go back that far, it would be when my name changed all of a sudden and I got confused. Some people were calling me Rachel, some people, and then my grandmother say, no, she is not a Rachel. And so she pulled me aside and she said, Achute, your name is Achute and will always be Achute. And she explained the definition why I was named that. And she said, never forget who you are.
What do you wish was in place for new refugees, new people seeking asylum? What would have made it easier for you?
When people come to this country, and I'm talking about the experience that I went through, and I still see this, refugees or immigrant or someone will come here, oh, I'm giving you 6 weeks. I will pay your apartment, and in 6 weeks or 3 months, you have to find a job. Okay, you want this person to find a job. They don't know how to drive. Now you just leave them there. I can't pay for your light. I can't pay for your apartment. Now this person, you just put them out there to the world with no access. Yeah, you might be, you know, the organization might be able to come back like maybe every 2 months or every year. But the organization is there for that first 6 months. It's not enough for them to learn how to drive and be able to take care of themselves. So I really wish that the system can go deeper and see more instead of saying, okay, I don't have enough money to support you. I want you to go to work now so you can pay taxes. I want you to go to work now so you can support this and pay us back. Mm. If that was the thing you bring them to this country, you are wrong. Then you did that because of business, the way I looked at it right now. And so I would wish that all of this organization, I appreciate them. They gave me life. I came here with nothing but an open-toed shoes. Today, I am a house owner. I have a house. Mm. My children have cars. I did that, me. I did it. Sometimes I don't believe it. I'm like, oh my God, did I really did this? I do 2 jobs, 3 jobs. Because I fail. I don't want to fail like I did. Everything that happened to me, I was a child, so I can't dwell on that. So I'm like, okay, it's a wrap. Forget my past. Now I'm an adult. I'm going to do this for me. I'm going to work. My light is not going to cut off. It's not going to get cut off because I don't have enough money. I'm going to find another part-time job. Mm-hmm. So we are, and when I say we are, refugees, we want to work, but we want guidance. We want guidance.
From South Sudan to South Dakota is tonight at 7 p.m. at the Augustana University Chapel in Sioux Falls. Author Achute Dang will share her story, answer audience questions, and sign books. Her memoir is called Don't Look Back. It's the 2024 One Book Siouxland Pick. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.